Thanks, Henry. And hello, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here. I've got 45 minutes to convince you that things that happened 65 million years ago matter to you today, which is a tall order for 45 minutes. We're an amazing group. I gotta say, I'm really honored to be here at Colorado College. I have huge faith in places like this. And I have to say that over the last year, I've been bumping into, in all walks of life, graduates of Colorado College who are doing amazing things. So I have no doubt that your cohort will go forward and do amazing things. I'm not just blowing smoke. It's a privilege to be here to talk to you guys today. I'm a paleontologist, as Henry said, and really we make progress in paleontology by going backwards in time, a long ways in time. We use numbers that are incomprehensible, 4.567 billion years, the age of the planet, 66 million years ago, the age of the extinction of dinosaurs, end of the last ice age, 13,000 years ago. I mean, these are big numbers that really don't have any relevance to you on your daily calendar, but they do really matter in thinking about the future, and that's my goal for the next 45 minutes. So I'm a kind of a paleontologist that looks at rocks and sees the landscapes they used to be. I'm a paleobotanist. I study fossil plants. So I look at a coal mine. You see the coal mine. I see the swamp. And I see the place that it used to be. I mean, I see ancient landscapes now preserved in rock. And it drives my wife and everybody else nuts. I'll be driving down the road talking about ancient landscapes as I look at modern landscapes. My friends call this time travel with a shovel. And it truly is time travel. Paleontologists are way ahead of the science fiction people. We go back in time routinely. Helps to have artists to pull it back together and tell us the whole story. Now, you guys live in Colorado Springs, at least temporarily, for 4 years. An amazing place geologically. You have Garden of the Gods, Pikes Peak, and even these amazing rock formations. You look at them and say, that's an amazing rock formation. I say, that was once an ancient landscape that's turned to stone, turned up on end for our viewing pleasure. So Colorado Springs is like, it's like going to an IMAX movie for me. I'm like, when I travel through Colorado Springs, there's a dozen different ancient landscapes I see. I don't see the rest of it. I don't see the fast food joints. I don't see anything. I just see the ancient landscapes. That's because Colorado Springs is in this thing called the Denver Basin. It's a giant depression. The mountains are over on the left-hand side of the image. On the right, the flat plains of Colorado. And so the same rocks you see over there at Garden of the Gods are 12,000 feet below this building. So geologists can also see into the ground, not only back in time, but into the ground, which is kind of cool. Here's a geologic map of the Denver Basin. You can see Denver's in the middle of it. Colorado Springs is the bottom of it. For the last 20 years, I've been perusing the geology and the stories of the landscapes of the Denver Basin. And it's a rich story indeed. Here's that diagram of Denver, but you can imagine Colorado Springs is the same thing. 14,000 feet of layered rocks beneath the city. You can predict what's down there because you see it on the Front Range. So the landscape is very readable, and reading the landscape is just like reading a book. It's pretty easy. Now drop in geologic time. Here's a diagram from my friend Ray Troll, who's given us geologic time, all those periods you hate to memorize. The story of our planet's written in stone. Those layers of rocks have fossils. They tell you about ancient landscapes. They tell you about evolution and extinction and climate change. Those things are there to be read by anybody, anywhere. And right here in Colorado Springs, you can literally walk from this room to beautiful outcrops that tell that story. And that's what I'm going to do between now, when I finish the talk, and the evening talk by Ian at 7 o'clock. So there's Colorado College, and here's the geologic map around Colorado College, which means wherever you are, dig a hole, there's a story down there. I don't care where you are, it's under your feet. Look beneath your feet, the world's history is there. Right beneath the campus is the Pier Shale. It's a gray rock. Kind of surprisingly, it was the bottom of the sea when it was deposited. So dial the clock back 70 million years ago, and we find incredible things. This is a fossil from a McDonald's in Colorado Springs. It's a beautiful, pearly shelled ammonite. That's what these things look like. They're ancient squid relatives. They lived in the sea. They lived with these giant fishes. It's an amazing menagerie of animals that lived in the sea that covered Colorado Springs 70 million years ago. And the fossils are right down in the creek, right there. You can go find them. You can find sharks digging through the creek. So you live on this landscape. Most people don't know it. Drives me nuts. So I write popular books to help people understand things like this, like the idea of ancient Denver's. It used to be covered by the sea. The Rocky Mountains didn't used to have Rocky Mountains. It used to be the bottom of the sea. Denver used to not be a mile high. It used to be 600 feet deep. It's something to think about. So places like this. This is right up the street. This is Pulpit Rock Park. I look at those layers of rocks and go, you know, when were those laid down as sediments, and what kind of fossils do we find in those things? These are latest Cretaceous, about 66 million years ago. And in Denver, we cruise around building sites because it's the building sites where people are digging in the ground and exposing those rocks. And those rocks are often under a foot of soil. And they dig in and find things like this, which is a little bit unclear, but you flip it over and it's the skull of a triceratops. 8 feet long, 22 miles from my museum, collected in 2003. Nice fossil. So my mentality is this, like the people I really like to talk, I mean, I love talking to liberal arts students because they're going to go out and change the world, but I really like talking to bulldozer operators and backhoe drivers because those are the guys that dig all the time and those are the people I need to convert to the joy of fossils. Now, I've over-converted in some cases. I made a mistake with Dinger, the mascot of the Rockies. I won't do that again. Here's one of my friends, a four-year-old, next to a four-foot-long femur of a Tyrannosaurus rex found in a housing construction site in Denver. There are the banana-sized teeth of the largest terrestrial carnivore of all time found in Denver in a construction site. And for me, working at a museum where my job is to make discoveries, preserve the results, and communicate with the public, it's like taking candy from babies to have dinosaurs in your backyard. So here's Denver, 66 million years ago. Here's east of Colorado Springs, out in the Corral Bluffs. This is a 10-minute drive from here. Crawl the landscape, find the teeth of alligators, find the skulls of alligators. What's going on? Here's a modern Mississippi alligator. There's a Colorado Springs alligator, about this size. That's my friend Gary overreaching in his alligator grabbing. He dropped it and it bit him, but what can you do? We find the remains of fossilized palm fronds in Colorado Springs. So here's Colorado Springs, 64 million years ago. What's going on? It's a different world altogether than it is today. And that's what the fossils tell you, is the planet changes. It changes all the time. And what we are doing right now is kind of interesting. Humans for the last 200 years have been changing the planet really, really, really fast. I'll give you some examples in a minute. Here's what it looked like 16,000 years ago here. Mammoths and camels were your beasts, not Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus rex. That's a warm world. That's a cool world. We call those things ice house world and greenhouse world. We live in an ice house world. An ice house world is characterized by the presence of polar ice caps. A greenhouse world is characterized by the absence of polar ice caps. You've never experienced a greenhouse world. Why should you? You live in an ice house world. It's been ice house for the last 34 million years. Let's talk about ice house for a little bit. Ice house is sort of the uncommon condition. This graph shows from left to right 600 million years ago to now, so 600 million years of time. The blue bars show the times when Earth was ice house, when Earth had ice caps. Okay, what's that mean? It means that they're rarer than the non-condition. So greenhouses are more common than ice houses. It just happens that we live in an ice house, so we think that's normal. That's not normal. It's 15% of normal. 85% of normal is greenhouse. So an ice house has two kinds of conditions. It has what we have right now, these cool interglacial periods that we've been in for the last 10,000 years. And it has these cold glacial periods when ice gets aggressive, when ice comes to mid-latitudes. So you take a look at today. Let's go back to the glass glacial period, 20,000 years ago. Ice covered much of North America and northern Eurasia. Zoom into North America. I love a pointer and a glass of water if you could do that too. Thanks. But let's look at this. This is what North America looks like today. Here's what North America looked like 20,000 years ago, which isn't that long. Boom. See you later, Chicago, New York, Boston, and Seattle. Right. Now, these things came and went, like over the last 2.5 million years, it did this like 20 plus times, which is, you know, bad for real estate and all sorts of stuff. Right? I'm from Seattle, where we have the amazing Space Needle. I watched it being built when I was a little tiny kid. It's 600 feet tall, right? And there it is, right there. That's a 3,000-foot sheet of ice that covered Seattle 20,000 years ago. Things change. We learn a lot about ice in the ice house by coring the ice caps. We've cored Greenland many times, Antarctica many times. The Russians just busted through 13,000 feet into Lake Vostok, that great lake underneath the ice cap in Antarctica. And we're able to actually look back in those ice cores and look at how climate has changed. And one of the great discoveries of the ice cores is that the relationship between greenhouse gases and warmth and cooling the planet is quite distinctly arrayed in the cores. So you can see in this diagram, which just shows you now on the right again, 300,000 years ago over there on the left, and you can see it goes from warm periods to cool, to warm, to cool, to warm, to cool, to warm, and that's us right there. The last 10,000 years, human civilization, agriculture, cats and dogs, schools, museums, all that stuff, last 10,000 years. We're at the end of this amazing cycle of warming and cooling. The glaciers are the cool periods. The interglacials are the slightly warmer periods. So I always kind of wanted the museum to have a really cool ice age site to go along with our really cool greenhouse sites. And it turns out we found one 18 months ago in Snowmass Village. This is a map that shows what Colorado, the Central Rockies, looked like during the last big glacial. There's Snowmass Ski Area right there. And here's what Snowmass Ski Area looks like today. You've probably all skied there. There's the mall. This little round thing right here, this little lake, turns out to be the best high-elevation ice age fossil site in the world. It was discovered 18 months ago. Amazing discovery. Bulldozer drivers found a mammoth, then mastodons, then giant bison, then giant sloths. We launched this major excavation with literally hundreds of diggers. Using shovels and 300 people, we moved 8,000 tons of dirt in 70 days and collected 5,000 fossil bones from over 70 different animals. And you can see this amazing thing. We're just pulling bone after bone. We had days where we were pulling 300 bones out of the ground in this site last spring, not even 9 months ago. Thank you. Here's the skull of a gigantic bison, 6 feet from horn tip to horn tip. This massive animal, no one even thought about this thing. There it was in Snowmass. Here's the lower jaw of a mastodon. And here's the fauna from that site. We didn't know about this thing on October 13th, 2010. That's what museums do. We make discoveries, we do the excavation, we preserve the results, we communicate the findings. And here's what we know lived in the Colorado Rockies as recently as 50,000 years ago. This chunk of time here, it captures that last warm period, the cool period before our present warm period and our present time. So we did the fastest book on history. On November 1st, we had blank paper in front of us. And we wrote a book, and it's published, and it's sitting back there in 3 months. Ian Miller, who is right there, who's a Colorado College grad, is the co-author. And tonight at 7 o'clock in Gates Hall, third floor, he's going to be talking about the book. So if you want to know about Snowmass, come back tonight and hear Ian talk. He's a great speaker. All right, that's Ice House. What about Greenhouse? Totally unfamiliar to most of us because we don't actually spend any time there. It's before our time. It's 34 million years ago. I've spent the last 25 or 30 years digging fossils in greenhouses all around the world, and I've come to a conclusion like, here's what I think it looked like, and that's what I want to share with you right now, is what did greenhouse times look like? And it turns out that just like the ice house, which has cool and cold, the greenhouse has warm and hot, two conditions. I'll start with the warm. Here's the world 35 million years ago. Note the lack of polar ice caps. Here's it 50 million years ago. The continents are breaking up. No polar ice caps. One of the key curious things about greenhouse world is the polar regions don't have ice. They have forests, which is amazing. I mean, think about it. Today, it's so cold in the Arctic region above the Arctic Circle. The ground's frozen at times up to 3,000 feet deep. The tree line is south of the Arctic Circle. But if you go to places like Northern Greenland and Ellesmere Island, the very top, places that are closer to the North Pole than you are to the Arctic Circle. And look there. What do you see? Well, you see the evidence of today's ice house, these great big ice sheets. Very confusing photograph. This is an ice cap. That is a 300-foot-high waterfall right there. It's this giant sheet of ice lying on top of the land, just like the giant sheets of ice lay on top of Seattle 20,000 years ago. So going to the Arctic now is like going back to the cold phase of the ice house. It's also like going back to something else that's totally unfamiliar. Here's a giant block of ice. That's what I did after I graduated from college, is went and worked up there. That's me at the bottom of the ice, trying to come to grips with a place that's frozen so hard, yet the fossils tell a different story. We explored these islands, and Ellesmere is the size of Great Britain. It has a population of 300 people. The adjacent island, Axel Heiberg, is the size of Ireland. It's uninhabited. It's an amazing place. It's what's now called Nunavut. It's one of the most beautiful landscapes in the world, basically uninhabited by people, but inhabited by polar bears and muskoxen. But if you fly around there in choppers and land, you find these great big thick coal seams. And the coal seams are these white crumbly rocks. When you get close to those, they're actually standing fossilized tree trunks. And you can actually find fossil forests. And you can find the fossil leaves that grew on those trees in those fossil forests above the Arctic when the world was warm. And then things like this, I'm like, what kind of fossil is that? And paleontologists are really good at looking at pieces of things and seeing what the whole thing is. And I'm a paleobotanist, so I see that thing and I go, oh, that's the center part of a lotus leaf. So lotuses growing above the Arctic Circle 50 million years ago. Here's a diorama we built for the American Museum that shows the polar warm ecosystem of the greenhouse, warm world, not even the hot world, just the warm world. Here's what it looks like today. Polar bears and walruses. Here's the configuration of the Arctic Ocean 50 million years ago. And you can see one significant difference. It's much less open to the world's oceans. The Bering Sea is blocked by a land bridge. The northern Greenland channel is much more narrow. Europe and Greenland and North America were separated by strips of land. So you can imagine a warmer world. This is almost starts to act like a lake. I mean, here's what it looks like today. This is an icebreaker in the middle of the Arctic Ocean. And the in 2000, a group of Europeans and Americans decided they were going to take a ship out in the middle of the Arctic Ocean and drill through the seafloor and see what the history of the Arctic Ocean basin held. And they drilled down, and they got down to the level was about 47, 48 million years old, and they found an incredible horizon of fossil plants preserved as spores of this plant. This is Azolla. It's an aquatic fern that today grows in the tropics and subtropics and into the low, warm, temperate area. So here's a lake in Amazonia that's covered by Azolla. This is the Arctic Ocean of 50 million years ago. That's your warm greenhouse world. We have a really good example of it right here on the road to Denver. That's, you may recognize, Castle Rock. That's Interstate 25. And one of the things we do as we dig in the Front Range is we pay attention to when people are building things, because when they build things, they find things. And in Castle Rock, we've made this amazing discovery, both on the north side of the town and the south side of the town, right next to the freeway. Discovery was made in 94. We've been digging it ever since. Gigantic fossil leaves. Complete palm fronds. And tropical rainforest leaves have a very curious feature called the drip tip. Here's a photograph I took in Amazonia. See how there's a great extension on the tip of this leaf? That is a what's called a drip tip. And in forests where it rains more than 80 inches a year, remember you have about 14 inches a year of rain here, but in rainforests where it rains more than 80 inches of year rain a year, the leaves, if they don't dry out quickly, they get colonized by algae and fungus and lichens, and they're unable to photosynthesize. So most tropical rainforest leaves have this adaptation called a drip tip, which is basically a water wicking device that wicks the water off the leaf. So if you're in a tropical rainforest and it's raining and then it stops raining, everything's wet, but look at the leaves. They'll be dry. They'll drip dry almost instantly because of this drip tip. The water beads up, rolls off, the drip tip drops the water off, it springs back, and you have an instant leaf drying device in the form of the drip tip. So 80 plus inches of rain a year. Remember, we're at 14 today here in Colorado Springs. Here are the fossil leaves from Castle Rock, from the side of the road. They all have drip tips. What we'd found in Castle Rock was a tropical rainforest in Colorado 64 million years ago. Not only a warm world, it's getting a little bit hot. Here's a picture of my friend Bob. He walked through the tropical rainforest and said, Bob, stop at every tree you see, pick one leaf off that tree, stop when you've taken leaves from 100 trees and come back. He did that. He didn't get the same species twice. That's a pretty graphic representation of the high biodiversity of tropical rainforests, is that every tree in a forest is a different species. Try that in Colorado. You're not going to get very far. Every tree is almost the same species in Colorado. In a tropical rainforest, the aspect of biodiversity is high numbers of tree species. In some forests in the Amazonian area, you can get up to 400 species of trees in a two-acre plot. Incredible diversity. Here's the Castle Rock assemblage. The Castle Rock has the leaf size, the shape, the drip tips, and the diversity of tropical rainforests. It is, as we know now, the oldest known tropical rainforest in the world, and it's 30 minutes up the road on the way to Denver. Here's what it looked like in Colorado 64 million years ago. That's in the warm phase of the greenhouse, not the hot phase. So here's what the world looked like in the Paleocene. You can see that they were not, and this is the dark pattern is the distribution of tropical rainforests. And you can see that instead of having just tropical rainforests in the tropics, you have tropical rainforests in the tropics, but you also have them in mid-latitudes, north and south, where the temperature and rainfall are adequate for tropical rainforests. Again, a different world. And in this world, there were no polar ice caps, just forest all the way to the poles. A really different kind of place. Now, paleontologists have had tremendous breakthroughs with geologists in the last 30 years by getting different kinds of data, drilling into the ice cores, drilling into the sea floors. The Ocean Drilling Program has given us the ability to drive around the oceans and anywhere plug a hole in the mud of the bottom of the sea and reconstruct the history of the oceans. And it's pretty amazing what they found out. They've been able to use that kind of data to create an actual temperature curve through time. So in this curve, the bottom is 70 million years ago, the top is now. warm is to the right, cool is to the left. You can see it was warm for a while, and about 34 million years ago, we switched from being in greenhouse world to ice house world, and that's where we've lived for the last 34 million years. It's nice to have these ocean studies to give us much context for what we're doing on land. Let me talk a little bit about the hot times in the greenhouse world. Not the warm times, but the hot times. And we didn't even know about the hot times in the greenhouse world until 1993. It was a discovery based on ocean drilling programs. People looked in the cores, and they discovered this thing, the PETM. Henry Fricke, who introduced me, is someone who studies the PETM. He's one of the world's experts on this. It's a brief time of extreme warmth, where the warm world got hot, where the tropical forests of the mid-latitudes pushed up toward the Arctic Circle. Imagine that, subtropical forests at the edge of the Arctic Circle. Completely out of our experience, hard to believe, but the facts show it to be. And here's just a diagram. It's a very short-lived little burp. This is a time across the bottom that's only 2 million years of time. You can see this thing lasted for 100,000 years or so, a time when a warm world got 6 degrees centigrade, even warmer. And amazing things happened in that warm world. It's preserved, of course, in layers of rock. As we talked about before, the rock layers are the story of the planet. And this is a place in Wyoming, a very famous place called Polecat Bench, where the PETM, that extremely hot period in a warm world, is preserved as red stripes. The red stripes are actually fossilized tropical rainforest soil horizons. And they're full of fossils of little animals. Animals like this guy. This is Eohippus, the Don horse. It's also called Heracotherium. It's a little horse. These little horses first appear in North America and Europe around the time of the PETM. They're little guys. They're about 12 pounds. Imagine a 12-pound horse. A terrier-sized horse, which is kind of nuts. But what happened next is amazing, because the world goes from being warm to hot, and what do these little horses do? They dwarfed. What do you do when you dwarf a terrier-sized horse? You get a chihuahua horse. A 6-pound horse. Truth is way crazier than fiction. So we know that one aspect of a hot world is horse dwarfing. Don't worry about it. It's not a problem. And these are complicated problems that are studied by multidisciplinary teams of scientists around the world. One of the great things about being a scientist is you actually have friends in most countries. And as a paleobotanist, I can list 200 friends that are like the paleobotanist in Burma, and the paleobotanist in Kazakhstan, and the paleobotanist in Vladivostok, and the paleobotanist in Khabarovsk. I mean, it's this weird connected world of subject experts that try and work their way through things. And there aren't that many scientists, and there aren't that many paleontologists, so it's a lot of a big problem with not that many people trying to solve it. And so things like this. This is a giant fossil ant that was given to me by a guy named Louis Lube back in 1993, and he was his prized possession. He was 83 years old. He came to me and he said, look, I'm going to die soon. I want to give you my giant ant. I mean, that's what museums do. We preserve the treasures of the world, and giant ants are treasures. And I said, that's really awesome. Thank you for giving us the giant ant. And then it took me about 15 years before I was visited by a giant ant specialist, because there's not many giant ant specialists. And the giant ant specialist was like, oh, my God, that's unbelievable. Giant ants today live only in the tropical rainforests, and the fossil ones only come from the mid-latitudes of Europe. So this giant ant is showing us a time when the hot world allowed giant ants to cross the polar regions between North America and Europe. So and here's the hummingbird for size next to the giant ant. It's a giant ant. I mean, it's not seagull size or anything like that, but it's a big ant. So bear with me, the title, right? Intercontinental Dispersal of Giant Thermophilic Ants Across the Arctic During the Early Eocene Hyperthermals. When the tropics are hot enough that they're almost like the subtropics, tropical stuff jump from continent to continent. And what's really cool about that is we can see this both in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere. We've been studying fossils in Patagonia that are related to things in Australia. Because in a warm world, you had forests in Antarctica. And even warm tropical-loving stuff can get from Australia to South America when those continents are closer. And we had a great find about a decade ago. The guys I work with in Patagonia found the first Patagonian platypus, which annoyed the Australians to no end. Last year, we found the first eucalyptus in South America, which really annoyed them because the oldest eucalyptus in the world is in South America, not in Australia, where everybody thinks they have the only eucalyptus in the world. So what we're doing with these looking back in time is kind of rewriting the story of how the planet changed. What does it mean? Now, this is just a diagram showing how North America, Europe, and the root of the giant ants. All right. So I want to change gears a little bit and just talk to you about things in real time, because I can't expect you, representing as you do the breadth of disciplines taught in a liberal arts college, to be that interested in fossils and geologic time. You're probably interested in other things, art, humanities, whatever it is. It's all good. I want to go to real time now, and I just want to talk a little bit about what real time means to me. And I have an unusual relationship with time because I'm a paleontologist. I don't worry about 60 million or 300 million. But as a human living on the planet right now, I have a family. I grew up with my sister, and we have a time we live with. It's sort of the lifespan of a human. I am in the middle of my scientific career. I graduated from college in 1982. I probably got 20 more years of being a scientist. So that kind of time matters to me. The time of mortgages matters to me. What happens next year matters to me. So I want to start with this picture of this guy named Bert Pierce, who was born in 1879 in Sutton Veny in England. That's near the Stonehenge. And this guy had a curious profession. He was a shepherd, right? I mean, the shepherd is probably one of the oldest professions out there. We domesticated animals about 8,000 years ago, and that was probably the first good-paying job in the world, was a shepherd. But in 1879, there were still shepherds in England. And this guy is my grandfather. He immigrated to Wyoming at the age of 17 and became a rancher as a shepherd. This is my mom. She was born in 1929. She grew up on the ranch in Wyoming. She was a cowgirl. Then she kind of lived the American dream. She went to California with the Great Migration. She met my dad, who was a doctor. They married, had two kids. They lived the American dream. I went to liberal arts college. I get to be in rooms like this. And my sister, born in 1965, is a documentary filmmaker. Here's a picture of the little children soldiers in Darfur 2 years ago. Just a month ago, my sister had two kids, Felix and Viva. They're born in New York City, kind of reflecting this great trend of urbanization of humanity, going from being shepherds in a couple of generations to being urban hipsters. Many of you will go to Williamsburg, I know. So what's amazing about Felix and Viva is their great-grandfather was born in 1879 as a shepherd, and given normal life expectancy, these guys are going to live to see 2100 easily. I mean, presently, life expectancy is around 84 years in this country, and that means that with no problem at all, they'll live to see the year 2100, which seems like impossibly distant in the future, yet my nephew and my niece will be around in 2100, which makes me think about all this stuff, because to me, it's like, you know, 2100 seems like a long time in the future, and 1879 seems like a long time in the past, but I knew my grandfather, and I know my nephews and nieces, it's not that long, it's just three generations of my family. But look at this. Here's world population. When Bert was born in 1879, there was 1.6 billion people on the planet. When Katie Jo, my mom, was born, there were 2 billion people. When my sister was born in 1965, there were 3.3 billion people. And we all watched us roll 7 billion people last fall. So the planet has grown in size of population almost fivefold since my grandfather was born. That is rapid change. And don't think anything about the present time is normal at all. You guys live in the single most change-oriented part of human history that's ever existed. Your generation is going to ride this thing out. It's amazing. We're going to get the tail end of it. We'll get the front end of it. You'll get the back end of it. And by 2100, we'll be in a post-petroleum world. We're living in it right now. But petroleum is really what's driving this thing. It's the ability for us to have fossil fuels to get work done that we used to have to do ourselves. My body takes about 2,000 calories a day to run. But as a modern North American person, I use about 200,000 calories a day to run my life, to drive my cars, to heat my house, to everything. It's like I have 100 slaves helping me do everything I do every day. And that's what fossil fuels have given us. They've given us the ability for me and Ian to drive down here this morning, cover 70 miles in an hour, come talk to you guys, drive back tonight, no big deal. I'm going to fly to Provo tomorrow and give a talk, come back. We can travel the world with ease because we have fossil fuels. We know how much there is out there, and we know that we're pretty much going to be done with it in about 100 years. So we'll watch this. By the time you guys have your 50th reunion for college, and don't think it's going to be that far in the future, because my 30th is coming up this spring, and it seemed like yesterday that I was drinking beers in the fraternity. I mean, like, yesterday. So think about this then. Here's one of the most transformative curves of data ever produced. This is a guy named Charles Keeling. In 1957, he started thinking, you know, if greenhouse gases really are a problem, we got to start measuring them in the atmosphere. And no one knew really what the concentration of carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere on a regularized basis. And so he went to Mauna Loa in Hawaii, where he could get a good clean sample of the Pacific air, and he started measuring the concentration of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. And he measured it for his entire 50-year-long scientific career. He died a couple of years ago, and his son took over this amazing curve. So this data curve is his life. And you can see that it starts down low at about 310 parts per million, and it's presently up there at 393 parts per million. So it's gone up about 24% during the time of measurement in the last 50 years. Now, what's kind of curious is that's also my life. I was born in 1960, and I stand here in front of you right now as a 51-year-old. So that data was started being collected when I was born. That's me right there. This is where I graduated from college, and I'm 30 years out of college right now. So in my life, we have seen the composition of the Earth's atmosphere change in one critical element by 20%. That's not normal. And what's going on here? Well, think about this. I graduated from college in 1982, and the reason the carbon dioxide is going up is because of our fossil fuel use and our land use. That's what causes this excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So what are we doing? Well, we burn a lot of fossil fuels. I mean, we're using today, in the world, we're burning about 80 million barrels of petroleum a day, which is a lot. But think about it this way. The first petroleum ever burned goes way back, but the first commercial oil well was 1859. Most oil was burned through the first part of this last century. It wasn't very much. Turns out that half of the oil that's been burned ever in the world has been burned since I graduated from college. And that's why we have increased CO2 in the atmosphere, is we're burning the stuff like mad. We're taking carbon that was buried in a greenhouse world, and we're combusting it to do all the stuff that we do. Drive around, fly around, play with iPads. All that stuff is a function of carbon dioxide burning. Now, does it matter? I mean, there's a tremendous debate going on in the country right now about does it matter or not. A lot of people will tell you it doesn't matter. A lot of people will tell you it's a hoax. A lot of people are giving lots of different kinds of information. I would say, as usual, follow the science. So here's that same graph I showed you before. And you can see that the red line is the temperature. The blue line is the CO2. And they're almost completely overlapping through the entirety of the ice, the last 300,000 years of the ice age. Let's plot today's number on this graph. There's 393. That's the data that was taken in Mauna Loa a month and a half ago. You can see that it is way off the scale. What this is telling me, and it's what it's telling scientists, is that we are leaving the ice house. That condition the planet has been in for the last 34 million years ago, sayonara. We're going to what? Well, it turns out that the paleontology time travelers can tell you where we're going. We're going to the greenhouse. How fast are we going to get there? Interesting question. Look at this graph. I apologize for this graph. Maybe hard to read, but on this graph, now it was on the far left-hand side. That's zero. Over here is 50 million years ago, my kind of time. The big jagged thing is concentration of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere. You can see that during the greenhouse times, you have numbers that are bouncing around between 800 and a couple thousand parts per million. Remember that it's 393 now. So simple pattern here is that during the ice house world, you have CO2 well below 1,000 degrees ppm. During the greenhouse, it's above 1,000. So we have 393 here. What's the problem? What's to worry about? Well, this red bar is the IPCC. That's the Intergovernmental Programming. What is it anyway? What is IPCC, Henry? Intergovernmental Program of Climate Change? Panel. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Thank you, audience. This is their sort of, if we don't do anything, if we just keep burning fossil fuels and we just let fossil fuels drive the economy, if we still have our growth passages, if we have human population growing unchecked, if we're 9 million people by 2060, this is what we expect to see by the year 2100. Somewhere in the vicinity of 1,000 ppm plus or minus a couple of hundred. Which means that my nephew and my niece will live in a world that has the global atmospheric composition of a greenhouse, not an ice house. So it's right out there. It's like, it's one generation out there. It's my nephew and my niece living in that world. Now, what does that mean? Well, I mean, we don't know how long it's going to take to melt away the ice caps. But we do know that those conditions are unstable for ice caps. We do know we're entering a different climate. So, I don't know, I like to end with this image. What is this? This is, if you go to Australia, which you should all go to Australia, and you go up to the north side where these gigantic crocodiles live, Kakadu and the Dane Tree and places like this. In the Kakadu, they have these little tourist boats that go out, and they take a broom handle, and they attach a dead chicken to the broom handle. And they drive around, and they hold the broom handle out the side of the boat. And they've got tourists on the boat, and what they're trying to do is to get a little crocodile to jump up and grab the chicken off the broom handle. And it's pretty amazing. And most of the crocodiles are like 8 feet or 9 feet long. They're like the size of the ones that Gary was trying to wrestle. But this picture is taken when, to everyone's amazement, a 22-foot crocodile. And let me just tell you, if you don't know about crocodiles, the little ones are cute, the medium-sized ones are beautiful, and the big ones are terrifying. And a 22-foot crocodile is absolutely terrifying. I mean, that these kind of animals eat people all the time in Australia. About every 3 years, there's a crocodile fatality when one of these guys just eats a person. And what I like about this picture isn't, in fact, not the crocodile. I know about the crocodiles, but on the right, you can see people. And then what you see is there's three people right in the middle that are just taking pictures of their smartphone. Like, they're just watching it through their phone. And then this person is just doing his job. He's just holding the broom handle. And there's this person who's kind of recoiling in horror. And there's this person who's got his hand to his chin, and he's like being pensive, and he's pondering what's going on. So I submit to you that where we are in human culture right now with global warming is just this very scene. There's some people that are doing their jobs. There's some people that are just looking through their iPhones. There's some people who are scared just out of the... I mean, like, this guy is reasonable. That's a 22-foot-long crocodile. And there's this person thinking, what are we going to do about it? So I don't know what we're going to do about it, but I do know it's happening, and we can see it really clearly. And what is very frustrating to me as a scientist and a denizen of the greenhouse Earth is that most people don't know the story I just told you. And it's up to you guys. I mean, Colorado College is fabulous. You're going to go out and change the world. And you will live to see this thing through its back end. You'll live to see a post-petroleum world. You'll live to see a world where we won't be burning petroleum, maybe because we've run out, or maybe because we realize that burning it titrates the atmosphere in a way that's going to change our planet to a condition we haven't seen in 34 million years. Whatever you do, have fun at it. Thanks a ton.